Morning, everyone. Welcome to week three of the series. We had a bunch of different cancellations today, so we're a smaller crowd. Just before we start, just to remind everyone, for those who'd like to join, we have a two-week Kabbalah course coming up this Monday night and the next Monday night called the Kabbalah of Ten Commandments. That's the 30th of April and the 7th of May. So we began a series 2 weeks ago basing it on the works of Rabbi Dr. Twersky, and also bringing in an article by Chloe Madonis, the tongue-in-cheek article on 14 ways to be miserable, which we're going to have a look at some of that today as well. Just want to begin with a little bit of a review. So far, we talked about the different layers that we have within our personality. So we talked about we have the subconscious. We've got conscious and preconscious, which is more sort of the things we're aware of. And then the emotion, as we talked about last week. Now, the subconscious, as we said, is the hard drive which stores everything that we ever encountered and experienced. And one and three, meaning the subconscious and the emotion, are both irrational and impulsive and team up to play tricks on the mind and to bring in negative thoughts and other interfering influences, even when they make no sense and they're completely irrational. And last week, we had a look at a little bit of a table where we talk about the world of chaos and the world of order. And when we live our lives based on the influence of the subconscious connecting to the level of emotion, and we sort of bypass the conscious mind, we end up with the animalistic forces within ourselves, which is the world of chaos. So we had a look at this table. The world of chaos is driven by impulse, becomes egocentric, it's chaotic and reactionary. There's no congruence, which means there's no connection between the various layers working together, and we end up with a lack of mastery. We're not able to control ourselves, not able to control our responses, and so on. Whereas the godly force within ourselves is the world of order, which is where we take hold of our conscious mind and we are able to make proper decisions, and that's driven by intellectual decision making. It's much more selfless because it focuses on the truth, submits to a higher force, orderly, calm, proactive, and achieves mastery, and so on. Now, we said that the step one, in order to have healthy responses and to make sure that our emotions work in a healthy way, because as we said 2 weeks ago, the personality of the person lives in the world of emotion. That's where we are. That's where we live, in our emotional responses, because emotions, by definition, is how we respond to the outside world, how we react to experiences, to people, to anything that's happening around us. But in order to make sure that's healthy, we have to take control of the conscious mind in a healthy way, in a way that's not influenced and not impacted upon by the hard drive of the subconscious in an impulsive and reactionary way. And we do that, as we said at the end of last week, we do that by linking the conscious mind to the essence of the soul, the essence of who we are, which is that spark of truth, that spark of clarity, that spark of wanting to do selflessness, that godly spark that lies at the very core essence of who we are. Now, last week we talked about the concept of Rabbi Twersky explains the idea of assertiveness. And we talked about the difference between being passive, which means doing nothing, or assertive or aggressive. And just to sum up, and we talked about this at length last week, but just to sum up, we linked the non-assertive, meaning the passive and the aggressive, both share something in common. Because when we talk about assertive, we're not talking about arrogance. We're talking about, because there's nothing greater than humility and selflessness and so on, but we're talking about having a strong sense of clarity coming from a strength rather than a weakness. Because non-assertive, when a person is passive or aggressive, they're both reactions that have to do with the perception of the outside world. So the example we gave is that simple example of someone asking you for a lift to the airport at 6 o'clock in the evening, and you know your family's waiting for you with guests at home. So the passive person can't say no. It's out of a weakness, they say yes. But really, the decision is not coming from a strength. The decision is coming from how that person might perceive me. I'm too scared to say no. What will they think of me? They might be angry with me, and so on and so forth. The aggressive approach is to sort of scream at the person, how dare you ask me to do such a thing with such short notice? and so on. That's really also got to do with how we perceive them. Whereas the assertive response is the one coming from inside. It's one coming from a healthy self-perception. It's one coming from wanting to do what's right. It's a sense of clarity, a sense of respect, a sense of morality. So it might be something like, I'm terribly sorry, I'd love to help you, but can't. I could say no, but it's respectful. Maybe I can help you if you can't afford, I can help you with an Uber. Just that example we gave last week, which is a simplistic example, but really ties into everything that we do during the day. So assertiveness is humble, but it's coming from a strength, and it's coming from a sense of clarity, and therefore we're able to create the boundaries when we need to. We're able to create the connections the way we're supposed to, and not feel guilty about them. Sometimes it means saying no. Sometimes, obviously, again, selflessness is still the ideal. Not to take ourselves too seriously is still the ideal, but it's coming from a sense of strength and purity and clarity rather than from a weakness.
Just wondering if passive-aggressive is just the same thing as passive-aggressive.
Sometimes, yeah. So it's the same idea, yeah, because it's just another form of not knowing how to deal with it from a sense of strength. Yeah, yeah. I once mentioned this to you, but just because it's got to do with our identity, just to mention it briefly, there's a guy called Sean. Oh, here we are. Sean Stevenson, a motivational speaker. When he was born, he said the doctors told his parents that he would be dead within the first 24 hours of his life, and 35 years later, the doctors are dead, and he's the only one that remains. Right? That's what he says. But he talks about a number of lessons in his motivational. It's a TED talk. You can Google it. He says, never believe a prediction that doesn't empower you. In other words, the idea of giving yourself strength. And his second lesson is that you are not your condition. In other words, he says, he's not disabled. He has a disability, but he sees himself. That's that idea of going to the core essence of who the person is and coming from inside out rather than from outside in and living your life coming from that sense of strength. Okay. Now, what I want to do today is have a look at some strategies of taking control of the conscious mind so that we can block out those irrational influences that come often from the subconscious. And what I want to do is start with an example from Chloe Medanis' article. Now, again, if you didn't hear me talk about it a few weeks ago, this is a tongue-in-cheek article. It's an article which talks about happiness. And she says that everyone talks about being happy, and yet everyone engages in strategies that make them unhappy. And she talks about, in a joking way, the benefits of being unhappy and miserable, that everyone will take you seriously and feel pity for you and so on and so forth. And then she says she's going to talk about the 14 skills and teach you how to master those skills of being unhappy. So one of them is the idea of fear. And she talks about fear of economic loss, but the truth is the idea what she talks about is true with all fear. So she says the following. She says, let's get right to it and take a look at some effective strategies to become miserable. This list is by no means exhaustive, but engaging in four of the five. He said, you don't need all 14. If you just do four or five of these, you'll be miserably unhappy. Right? So what's her first one? The first one, she says, is be afraid. Very afraid. And look at some strategies. And in hard economic times, she says, many people are afraid of losing their jobs or saving. I just put an excerpt there, but I'm reading it to you. She said, the art of messing up your life consists of indulging in these fears, even when there's little risk that you'll actually suffer such losses. Right? Concentrate on this fear, make it a priority in your life, moan continuously that you could go broke any day now, and complain about how much everything costs, particularly if someone else is buying it. Right? Try to initiate quarrels about other people's spending habits and suggest that the recession has resulted from irresponsible fiscal behavior like theirs. Then she goes on to say, she says, fearing economic loss has several advantages. First of all, it'll keep you working forever at a job you hate. Right? Second of all, it balances nicely with greed, an obsession with money, and a selfishness. Right? And third, it says, not only will you alienate your friends and family, but you'll likely become even more anxious, depressed, and possibly even ill from your money worries. So that's a good job. And then she ends off the strategy by saying, here's the exercise. She says, sit in a comfortable chair, close your eyes, and for 15 minutes a day, meditate on all the things you could lose, your job, your house, your savings, and so forth. Then brood about living in a homeless shelter. Right? It's a very, very funny article. Okay. The truth is, however, as silly as this sounds, we all do this. Because we might not do it to the extreme, but we all have fears and worry and get anxious about things that we don't need to get anxious about. That either won't happen or that we can't control anyway, or that are just destroying the moment where we're in and it's something that's really relevant in 3 weeks from now, but I'm stressing out about it now for no reason, right? So I want to share with you a letter. This is an amazing thing. I just discovered this recently. It's a letter written in 1829. And it was written by a great Hasidic master known as the Tzemach Tzedek. It's a picture of him. He was the grandson of Rav Shneur Zalman of Ladi, the first Chabad Rebbe. And he wrote this letter. He was a very, very famous and great Hasidic master in Russia and Poland. And he wrote this to a mechutin of his, in other words, someone who had married one of his children, I think, called Rabbi Shlomo Freidish of Shklov, who obviously was going through a tough time and he had different fears about things and he was scared about different things. And word came to the Tzemach Tzedek that this was the case, or he had communicated with the Tzemach Tzedek that he's suffering from this sort of these anxious thoughts and these negative thoughts that sort of seem to interfere with his lifestyle or whatever the case is. And the Tzemach Tzedek writes him a very interesting letter. Part of what's interesting about it is that some of the things he says there, and we'll get to it, is now being discovered through modern scientific research. You've all heard me say this before. A lot of very, very positive things that are discovered these days with real modern scientific research, for which they invest thousands, sometimes millions of dollars. If they would just save the money, I could show them where the sources are for these things in Torah teachings. And often they've been there for hundreds or thousands of years in Jewish literature. But one of the things he says very clearly, and I'll show you an amazing thing that he actually talks about, which has now been talked about more recently. I actually want to dedicate sharing this letter for a particular reason, because I'll tell you how I discovered this letter. There's a, unfortunately, my Dina's brother-in-law's brother, not related to us, but her brother is actually very, very sick at the moment, and the family has started like a WhatsApp group, and part of the idea of the WhatsApp group is to, please God, it'll be okay, but part of the idea of the WhatsApp group is to share Torah thoughts on bitachon, on trust, and emunah, and positive thinking, and so on. So one of this person's brothers, the other day, shared this letter. He discovered this letter from the Tzemach Tzedek, and he spoke about it on the WhatsApp. He read it, and I went looking for it and found it. So the person that's unwell, so I'll dedicate it for his schut, for his merit, Aharon ben Chana, should have a speedy recovery. So he says the following. The Tzemach Tzedek writes like this. So first of all, he establishes the facts. He says to him, I've just put point forms, but I'm going to read you part of that. He says, regarding the fears that you have, he says, even though it's for nothing, but I haven't held myself back from writing that which is in my heart, he says. He says, first of all, one of the things one should do is pray to God for happiness, for inner happiness. And he quotes a verse from King David, who turned to God and said, Sameach nefesh avdecha, make the soul of your servant happy. And you should put effort and invest effort to remove from yourself all types of stress and worry. Then he continues and he said, He said, what I do want to point out is that many times there are fears which are self-inflicted, and the person has a choice to remove them. That's what he says. He says fear is a decision at the end of the day. Now, often it doesn't seem that way, because we get very anxious about things and it seems like we're out of control, right? But he says, the first thing I want to establish is that many, many fears are things we worry about, things that we impose upon ourselves to worry about them, and really we have a choice whether to worry about them or not. So he says, what's the proof for this? What's my proof from the Torah teachings? He says, some laws of warfare. If you look in the Torah, there's a whole section in Deuteronomy that God communicates to Moses to communicate the Jewish people before they go into the land of Israel, where it was obvious that we're going to have to fight certain wars. And it says that there are laws of how Jewish people conduct warfare. One of them is that it says, Al yeirach levavchem, which means, do not have a scared heart. Do not go into war when you are with fear. Now, it's one of the mitzvot, one of the commandments of the Torah, not to engage in warfare with worry and fear, but to trust that God will assist in winning the war. And the Tzemach Tzedek says a very simple equation here. We have a fundamental Jewish principle that any one of the 613 commandments of the Torah, or any one of the rabbinic commandments, a person has bechira, a person has free choice. Right? God does not command us to do something for which we have no choice. In other words, we always have a choice whether to choose right or wrong, whether to choose to do the mitzvah, not to do the mitzvah, engage in the negative behavior, not engage in negative behavior. It's purely a choice. right? Therefore, the Torah commands us not to be scared, and that's one of the mitzvot of the Torah, as the Rambam explains. He says it must be that there's a choice here. The choice is whether to be scared or not, which seems really strange, because fear is an emotional thing, and often it seems like we're not in control of that fear. So he says, okay, but that's he establishes that as a principle. And then he goes on to explain why and what the strategy is. Now, I need to give you a little bit of an introduction to the next part. Because you heard me say this before in a different context a little bit, so I want to make it very clear. In Kabbalah, we have something called the garments of the soul. Now, garments are a relative thing. When we've talked about the five layers of the soul, which is the essence, the cognition, emotion, the essence, subconscious, cognition, emotion, and behavior, we've talked about the first four being sort of more garments and the essence being who you really are. But the truth is that in many, many, many places in Kabbalistic teachings, it talks about the three garments of the soul, which means that even cognition is more sort of who we are, even our emotions is sort of who we are, but whatever we think and whatever we feel has to find some means of expression to exist. And every person has three means of expression. And the three means of expression are machshava, thought, speech, and action. And they are known in Kabbalah as the three garments of the soul. Why are they called garments? And these are even more garments as the garments that we talk about sometimes. These are the real garments of the soul, because it's not the soul itself. In other words, let me give you an example so it's clear. Speech is a garment. Speech is not me. Speech is the garment, an expression of me. Why? Because I could, as we've talked about many times, the words of speech are as good as the content that I put into them. In other words, I can talk gibberish for the next 10 minutes, or I can talk nonsense and no one will know what I'm talking about. Even I won't know what I'm talking about. And it'll just be words, empty words that mean absolutely nothing. Because words themselves are not my feelings. Words themselves are not my ideas. It's an expression of my idea. It's an expression of my feelings. So the way it works is there's a tremendous connection between my thoughts and my feelings and the garments, which means that my thoughts, or my ideas, I should say, not thoughts, my raw ideas or my raw emotions in order for them to exist, they have to find some means of expression. Either expression to myself in my own thoughts, or speech, or action, right? Is that clear? Yeah? Now, why we call these things levushim, why we call these things garments, is because a garment is something that's not you, and a garment is something you have full control over. Which means, while I cannot change my body, for example, I can change my garments. I have full control whether to wear a particular garment or not to wear a particular garment, right? And therefore he says the strategy for this choice to be afraid or not to be afraid is to take control of the conscious mind through the garments. So he looks at thought first, right? So you see, let's go back to what we discussed. Where does fear come from? Fear is irrational fear does not come from our conscious mind. It comes through our conscious mind. Irrational fear is triggered by the subconscious mind. So why do some people become very anxious about certain things irrationally? It could be because that's their protection mechanism, their stress mechanism. It could be because that's their nature. It could be because that's associated with an experience they had many, many decades ago, as we explained 2 weeks ago. Right? It could be to do with an association of an experience, they're feeling vulnerable, whatever the case is, but it's not a conscious decision, it's triggered by the subconscious. It comes through the conscious mind, it comes through the three levels of cognition, which is called Chochma, Bina, and Daat, as we've said many times, and then what that does is it triggers the emotion of fear. So it's starting off triggered by the subconscious, coming through the conscious, and then hitting the emotions. So how do you get rid of it? He says the only way any of this can have any expression is through the garments. And the garments you can change. And therefore he says, every person has three garments. Thought, speech, and action. And they control the conduct and the behavior of a person. And with these garments, I'm reading it to you, I'm translating it, there's the choice and the permission given to think, to speak, or to do according to the way you want. And therefore, even if someone is afraid, that fear, that idea of fear, can only exist if it finds expression in your thoughts, and you have a choice to stop thinking about it. It's a choice at the end of the day. It might be a difficult choice. But we can control our thoughts. We cannot control the initial fear or idea or concept popping into our mind, but we can remove negative thoughts from our thinking. And therefore he says, the main thing is not to think or to speak about it at all, but rather the other way around. In other words, don't engage in the thinking. And it's something which we call in the Talmud called Hesech HaDa'at, because he explains, he said, that what happens is, if we allow the thinking to continue, then it goes through the cognition mechanism called Da'at, which is knowledge, or connection to the thoughts, which then triggers our emotion. But if you remove it from your thoughts, that's what the Gemara, the Talmud calls Hesech HaDa'at, distract yourself away from those thoughts, which will inevitably mean you have to think about something else, which he's going to explain in a minute. And therefore he says, removing the negative thoughts, removing the thoughts of fear, means removing any means of expression of that subconscious triggered fear that you have within yourself, and therefore automatically the emotion will dissipate. It sounds obviously easier than it is, but that's the concept, right? Now, I don't know if you remember this, we did this a while ago, where we talked about a book by Russ Harris, based on the therapy called ACT, which now I've forgotten what that acronym stands for. But the concept was, he talked about this, and he gave the analogy, I don't know if you remember, he gave the analogy of a bus driver. Right? And he says, there's no question that we'll always have these thoughts that pop into our mind. That's what's going to happen. We all have and the way we explained it the last few weeks, it's a simple idea. We all have a subconscious mind. We all have things that are irrationally going to be triggered from the subconscious mind, and therefore we're always going to have these foreign or distracting negative experiences or thoughts that are going to pop into our mind. So Russ Harris gave the analogy, which is very similar to what we've been talking about, just makes it more sort of tangible. He said it's like the bus driver gets onto a bus and he is in control of that bus. But he also has on that bus many, many passengers. And sometimes those passengers become annoying passengers and negative passengers, and they start to distract. So the only thing the person can do is ignore them. In other words, you can't pretend the passengers aren't there, because they are there. I mean, until you have an opportunity to open the bus and get them off. But until such time, the passengers are on the bus. Now, it's up to the driver to decide the noises that they're making, or the screaming that they're doing, or the things that they're saying, is it going to interfere with my driving, or it's not going to interfere with my driving. It's my choice. So if the bus driver decides to ignore, the disturbances from those passengers on the bus, he will then be able to continue driving his bus securely and comfortably, because he's in control of the bus. They don't drive the bus. They just create distracting influences. So it's up to the person to then decide, am I going to take them on board? Am I going to think about them? Am I going to let them disturb me? Or am I going to ignore them? Let's say Mach Tzedek here is making the point, you have the choice to ignore those ideas, because the ideas need expression in your thoughts, and the thoughts is one of your levushim, it's one of your garments, and those garments you're in control of. You can stop thinking about it. You can think about something else. You can engage in different thoughts, and therefore you can kill any expression that those ideas, those emotions have, so they don't come into the consciousness, and that you're able, through the conscious mind, to decide what you're going to be thinking about, to decide which ideas you're going to be exploring, so that those subconscious, irrational, negative thoughts actually have no means of expression. Now, when we talked about this, just to clarify, we did talk about that it's not always the case of ignoring. We do have sometimes where we have to engage in those negative thoughts, and it depends where they're coming from. If they're coming from irrational fear and things that don't really make any sense, like the things that Chloe Medanis was talking about sitting, thinking about, worrying about economic losses that probably won't happen and exaggerating them and so on and so forth, then the only way to engage them is just to ignore it. The only way is to do what the Tzemach Tzedek is suggesting, that to use the expression of thought to actually completely think about something else. However, sometimes we have emotions or we have responses that have to do with the conscious mind. For example, it has to do with interpreting someone else's behavior. Now, that's different, right? There you can't ignore, there you've got to reframe and reinterpret. For example, if someone did something to me that has made me upset and it's bothering me, That's an emotion, that's a response. But that response has to do with the way I interpreted their behavior. Then the only way I can't ignore it, or sometimes I could ignore it, but often it doesn't help, because what that person did is hurtful and offensive, or whatever the case is, and I've got to try and engage in what this week's Torah portion talks about, which is something like judging favorably. And judging favorably means to reinterpret the situation. The person didn't really mean to cut me off. The person didn't really mean not to invite me. Maybe it was a mistake. Maybe they were stressed, so they said something that came out wrong. So there you're more dealing with the thoughts. But the type of things you're talking about here is worry, which is self-inflicted, or fear, which is self-inflicted, or any negative subconscious trigger that has made my conscious mind be the recipient of these subconscious triggers, and therefore brought about all kinds of emotions which are irrational and stupid, and we know it's stupid, right? That's the idea of her article. We know we all want to be happy, and yet we all entertain these thoughts and keep them, and we engage in things that make us unhappy. So we think about things, we're scared about things, we get anxious about things, and we know that that's wrong, and we kind of can't help ourselves. Even though if you ask a person, do you want to be happy or unhappy, they'll look at you as if you're crazy. Of course they want to be happy. And yet, we sort of engage in these things which are invading us. They're invading our mind. They're invading our hearts. And that Tzemach Tzedek's point here is, the only way is you can use one of your garments, like the thought process, to be able to completely ignore it and not give it expression so that it goes away. Then he continues and he says, it's not just enough to stop thinking about it. And I think that's particularly true when it comes to thought, because we have to think all the time. So therefore, we have to think about something. So he says, the next step that is, you have the power to remove those negative thoughts, but then what you have to do is, you have to replace those thoughts with something positive, right? So we need to replace the mind with good thoughts, right? In other words, again, it's getting back control of the conscious mind. We have to decide what we're going to think about. We have to decide what our thoughts are going to give expression to. And we need to decide, and we can through the medium of thought, saying, I'm not going to think and therefore give expression to the irrational thoughts that are the irrational emotions that are coming from my subconscious, but rather I'm going to decide what I'm thinking about. I'm going to let my thoughts give expression to the conscious mind, and therefore I'll decide what I'm going to think about, and I'm going to actively engage in thinking about things that are more meaningful and more purposeful and more positive and more happy. And then he moves on to the next one of the garments, because thought is only one garment. And he says, at the same time, obviously you need to make sure you don't talk about negative things. Because one thing we do know, we've talked about this many, many times, that if you have something negative going on, if you have an idea coming from the subconscious mind which is triggering an irrational negative thought, and you speak about it, it will get 10 times worse. Because speech has an amazing power of its own right, that it enhances an emotion. So when you have an emotion which is being triggered by something from the subconscious mind, and then you talk about it, it will become inflamed. And therefore, the only thing, therefore, he says, is to not talk about it. Again, the second garment. The second garment of the person, the means of expression is speech. Don't talk about it. Even if you're thinking about it, try and distract yourself. Remove the thoughts. Think about something positive, and definitely don't talk about it, right? Now, again, that's not always the case, because we do have a principle that comes from King Solomon, that sometimes it's good to offload, and it's good to talk about things that we're going through with other people. That's why we need to reach out, and we need to get the support from other people. But again, we're not talking about the same thing here. When do we need to talk about, that's if we've gone through a legitimate stress thing, a legitimate trauma. People go through grief, people go through difficult times, they have real difficulties, legitimate difficulties, and we all have some of those, that's fine. Then a good way is to talk them through with someone else. And even then, with a positive aim, with a positive goal. But here we're talking about things that are not triggered legitimately. They're not things that we've consciously gone through and we're suffering through a difficult time, a difficult challenge, right? We're talking about things that are just triggered. We're talking about a person who wants to be happy and yet can't, because the subconscious is sending all these signals that are just intrinsic and impulsive and reactionary, irrational type of emotions. There, it doesn't help to talk it through. The only way is to ignore it. The only way is to replace it with positive thoughts and with positive speech. Definitely not to invite negative speech, because negative speech will just inflame the whole thing. And then he says something very interesting. And he says, what you should be doing, he says, act happy. Now, I'll tell you exact words. He says, להרות בעצמו תמיד תנועות מסמכות כאילו הוא מלא שמחה בליבו. He said, you need to engage in actions, listen to this, in actions which are look happy, as if you are tremendously happy. Afalpi, even though he says that it's not in your heart, but the end you will become happy. Because he says the fundamental principle, which we've talked about many times, he says the actions of a person, sorry, the heart, as a famous Sefer Achinuch says, the heart of the person eventually follows the action. This is a very, very powerful strategy. He says that what you need to do, you need to replace the thought, ignore the thought. Not think about things that are making you worry. Replace them with good thoughts. Don't talk about negative things, talk about good things. And then when it talks about the third garment of expression, engage in positive garments. And he says, make tunuot shel simcha, make, act happy, I don't know, dance, smile, do things that are happy. Now obviously the response of a person who's really worried and anxious and depressed or whatever, I'm talking about not clinically depressed, but which is a physiological thing, by the way. I'm talking about someone who's just down. I look at you as if you're crazy. What do you mean act happy? But I'm not happy. Why should I? Why should I act happy? Why should I smile when I'm not in the mood? People often say that. I don't want to smile. I'm down. Like it's my right, you know, my right to be unhappy today. All right? He says, no, you got to force yourself to do things which are happy because it will bring you to happiness. This is what he says, and he bases it on the writings of Maimonides, the writings of the Mishnah, and the famous writings of one great author called the Sefer HaChinuch. Now what's amazing about this is the following. This is what I was talking about before, about sometimes it takes the secular world generations to figure something out that has been actually in Jewish thinking for hundreds and hundreds of years. There's a TED talk that I saw recently by a woman called Amy Cuddy. I don't know if I'm pronouncing her name right, but that's what it is. So she says, she's a social psychologist, right? And she says that scientists have spent a lot of time looking at the effects of our body language. Now, she starts off with a premise like this. Today, there's an amazing amount of study done into body language, right? And people who understand the meaning of different signs of body language will often make judgments based on body language. So he says we make sweeping judgments and inferences in body language. And they sometimes will predict the meaningful light outcomes like who we hire, who we promote, who we ask out on a date, and so on and so forth. Right? Now, she did an interesting thing. She took it a step further with a colleague of hers. Right? She said throughout all this, she became especially interested in nonverbal, what she calls nonverbal expressions of power and dominance. In other words, expressions that represent a person who's confident and in control and so on and so forth. Not in a negative way necessarily, but in a positive way. Right? Which, by the way, they've done research that this is true with animals also. The body language of animals apparently is very, very telling. So she said the way it works like this. You will see that when people feel powerless, people close up. Like they sort of, you know, you often see people who are not confident, who seem powerless, out of control. Their body language will sort of be like a withdrawal type body language, right? They don't want to bump into anyone. They're kind of scared of anyone that's around them, right? Whereas people who are very confident and in control normally have a very different body language. And she says it's more like open, and you see people wave their hands and they kind of spread themselves out more and so on and so forth. Again, not always in a negative way, but it's body language of openness, of confidence, of dominance, of control. Now, she was teaching a MBA class. And she says that, I'm just going to give you the background, because I want to show you something very interesting. She says, I'll read it to you. She says, I'm watching this behavior in the classroom, what do I notice? I notice that MBA students really exhibit the full range of power nonverbals, right? So you have people who come into the room, they get right in the middle of the room before class even starts. They really want to occupy space. When they sit down, they sort of spread out, they raise their hands like this, she says, right? Then you have other people who are virtually collapsing as they come in. As soon as they come in, you see it. You see it on their faces, their bodies, and they sit in their chair and they make themselves tiny, right? They withdraw, even when they raise their hand. You know, people in a lecture like raise their hand, they want to ask a question, but they're not sure, they're sure, you know, trouble the brother. Don't worry, I'm not an expert on body language. I'm not interpreting anyone over here. Okay. Now, she says that they noticed, and this had to, apparently it had an impact on the outcome of the performance and the marks and all type, how the students were actually performing in the MBA class. Now, you might not like this, but I'm just reading her work. She says, I noticed a couple of things about this. One, you're not going to be surprised. It seems to be related to gender. So women are much more likely to do this kind of thing, which is lack of control, she says. Women feel chronically less powerful than men. Did you know that? I didn't know that. So that's not surprising. So she says, in her school, business schools have been struggling with this gender grade gap, right? You get these equally qualified women and men coming in, and yet you get differences in their grades, and it seems to be partially attributable to participation. So she started to come up with an idea. If we can tell a person's feelings about themselves from their body language, could it work the other way around? This is what she started to think about. She obviously didn't read the Tzemach Tzedek's letter, but she started to think about this concept. Can we do it the other way around? If you force yourself to have a particular body language, right, can it then make a difference to how you think about yourself? So I'll play a little clip. Oh, no. Ah, here we are.
Go wild.
Oh, I should go over here.
To be partly attributable to participation. So I started to wonder, you know, okay, so you have these people coming in like this and they're participating. Is it possible that you could get people to fake it and would it lead them to participate more? So my main collaborator, Dana Carney, who's at Berkeley, and I really wanted to know, can you fake it till you make it? Like, can you do this just for a little while and actually experience a behavioral outcome that makes you seem more powerful? So we know that our nonverbals govern how other people think and feel about us. There's a lot of evidence. But our question really was, do our nonverbals govern how we think and feel about ourselves? There's some evidence that they do. So, for example, when we smile when we feel happy, but also when we're forced to smile by holding a pen in our teeth like this, it makes us feel happy. So it goes both ways. When it comes to power, it also goes both ways. So when you feel powerful, you're more likely to do this, but it's also possible that when you pretend to be powerful, you are more likely to actually feel powerful. So the second question really was, you know, so we know that our minds change our bodies. Is it also true that our bodies change our minds? And when I say minds, in the case of powerful, what am I talking about? So I'm talking about thoughts and feelings and the sort of physiological things that make up our thoughts and feelings. And in my case, that's hormones. I look at hormones. So what do the minds of the powerful versus the powerless look like? So powerful people tend to be, not surprisingly, more assertive and more confident, more optimistic. They actually feel that they're going to win even a game of chance. They also tend to be able to think more abstractly. So there are a lot of differences. They think more, there are a lot of differences between powerful and powerless people. Physiologically, there also are differences on two key hormones, testosterone, which is the dominance hormone, and cortisol, which is the stress hormone. So what we find is that high power alpha males in primate hierarchies have high testosterone and low cortisol. And powerful and effective leaders also have high testosterone and low cortisol. So what does that mean? When you think about power, people tended to think only about testosterone because that was about dominance. But really, power is also about how you react to stress. So do you want the high power leader that's dominant, high on testosterone, that's really stress-reactive? Probably not, right? You want the person who's powerful and assertive and dominant, but not very stress-reactive, the person who's laid back. You know, where can you actually apply this, which we care about, of course? And so we think it's really what matters and where you want to use this is evaluative situations, like social threat situations. Where are you being evaluated? Even by your friends, like for teenagers at the lunchroom table. It could be, you know, for some people, speaking at a school board meeting. It might be giving a pitch or giving we decided that the one that most people could relate to, because most people had been through, was the job interview. So we published these findings, and the media are all over, and they say, okay, so this is what you do when you go in for the job interview, right? Yeah, so we were, of course, horrified and said, oh my God, no, that's not what we meant at all for numerous reasons. No, don't do that. Again, this is not about you talking to other people, it's you talking to yourself. What do you do before you go into a job interview? You do this, right? You're sitting down, you're looking at your iPhone or your Android, not trying to leave anyone out. You're looking at your notes, you're hunching up things so small, when really what you should be doing maybe is this, like in the bathroom, right? Do that, find 2 minutes. So that's what we're going to test, okay? So we bring people into the lab, and they do either high or low power poses again. They go through a very stressful job interview. It's 5 minutes long. They are being recorded, they're being judged also, and the judges are trained to give no nonverbal feedback. So when I tell people about this, that our bodies change our minds, and our minds can change our behavior can change our outcomes, they say to me, it feels fake, right? So I said fake it till you make it, because
So essentially, it's a long talk. But essentially what they did was they did this study, and it turned out to be unbelievable that the people who engaged, not in front of the interviewer, of course, but before, privately, they engaged in confident, powerful sort of body language type stuff. When they came to the interview, they performed much better than the people who did the opposite. And they concluded that body language, or the way you move your body, the tnuat, as the Tzemach Tzedek calls it, the expressions, the movements of your body, can actually then impact on how you think about yourself and how you actually portray yourself afterwards. So this is a breakthrough, or apparently a breakthrough, but it's actually not a breakthrough, because again, it's in Jewish teachings a long time ago, that it was centuries ago in the Sefer HaChinuch, that the levushim, the garments of a person, the thought, speech, and action, and particularly action, although they're not the person, they're just the expression of the person, have an amazing, powerful impact on the person. And that's why the Tzemach Tzedek in his letter, he goes through a few stages. First of all, start with thought. You can choose what you think about. Don't think about the fear. Think about positive things. Don't talk about negative stuff. Talk about good stuff. And then action, make sure you engage in positive action, which is why he recommends that particular individual he's talking to actually, it can be in private. It can be things, do things that look happy, because later on she goes to say, the speaker there, she says, it's not about fake it till you make it, it's fake it till you become it. You know, you actually become that, because it works in reverse, that the garment that you get dressed into afterwards creates the person who you are, which is an amazing thing. And therefore she concludes, he says, the last thing I leave you with is tiny tweaks can lead to big changes. And she says, every day for 2 minutes, in private, engage in body language, which is positive, which is optimistic, which brings so more confidence, more dominance, and so on and so forth. That is, which reduces stress that will make for a better day. And it's an unbelievable. I just wanted to share that with you, because it fits right in to the recommendation of that particular letter. So back to the Tzemach Tzedek's letters. He says the following. He says, therefore, in summary, he says, make sure to guard your thought, speech, and action. Not to think about worry thoughts, to speak about positive things, and to engage in good positive actions. And then he says, at the end, he says, also, he says, he talks about gratitude. You need to replace that fear with gratitude, because he says to him the following. He says, first of all, he says, you really have nothing to worry about. You're doing well, and especially, this is what he writes to him, he says, especially that in this last summer, I know what happened to you. Obviously, something really positive happened to this person. And he said, in the last summer, there was a chut shel chesed, which is an expression in Hebrew, a thread of kindness that was over you the entire summer. He must have been the recipient of some amazing blessings. And he said, you seem to have forgotten about it. And one of the ways to deal with anxiety and deal with irrational thoughts of worry and fear is to actually make a point of remembering the good things that happened to us and engaging in the power of gratitude. And we know that today as well, that the power of gratitude is an amazing replacement for worry, for negativity, for pessimism, and so on and so forth. Which again links back to the happiness article, because she goes through number 7, the 7th strategy to be miserable, she says, is avoid gratitude. Research shows that people who express gratitude are happier than those who don't. So never express gratitude. Counting your blessings is for idiots. What blessings? Life is suffering and then you die. What's there to be so thankful for? Right? Well-meaning friends and relatives will try to sabotage your efforts to be thankless. Right? For example, while you're in the middle of complaining about the project you procrastinated on at work to your spouse during an unhealthy dinner, he or she may try to remind you how grateful you should be to have a job or food at all. Right? So she says, such attempts to encourage gratitude and cheerfulness are common and easily deflected. Simply point out that the things you should be grateful aren't really perfect, which frees you to find as much fault with them as you like. And she goes, as she does in the whole article, she says, an exercise, make a list of all the things you could be grateful for. Next to each item, write down why you aren't. Imagine the worst. When you think about the future, imagine the worst possible scenario. It's important to be prepared for and preemptively miserable about any possible disaster or tragedy. Think of the possibilities, the terrorist attacks, the natural disaster, the fatal diseases, the horrible accidents, the massive crop failures, your child not getting picked for the varsity softball team, and so on and so forth. Right? So that's the thing. So, but this is a very real thing. So we know that gratitude, and that's the sort of antidote. Tzemach Tzedek is saying you are in control of your thoughts. So don't think of negative things. Replace them with good thoughts. Speak good things. Engage in positive actions because the heart follows the actions. And also start to think about, occupy your mind with the things that you could be grateful for, and that lowers the level of fear, it lowers the levels of sadness and anxiety, and it upgrades the level of happiness. And then he ends off the letter with a very interesting thing, and he says, if you have to worry, so here's my suggestion. There is good worry too, right? There's something called healthy worry. And he quotes a Talmud which says that a person can connect to the depths of Jewish learning and connection to God if you have some level of worry about not being purposeful and connected to God in the proper way. So if you have to worry, worry about your spiritual welfare and do something about it. Right? He says, he ends off the letter. He says, if you have to worry. But I'm telling you not to worry, but if you must worry, at least channel it into some healthy worry that you could do. Now, just to share with you one last one from the article that the... Oh, no, let me do that. She says about anxiety as well, right? She says, optimism about the future leads only to disappointment. Therefore, you have to do your best to believe that everything will fail. Your children won't love you, your business will fail, and so on and so forth. And she talks about the concept of anxiety. She says, always be alert and in a state of anxiety if you don't want to be happy. But obviously, happiness comes from replacing that anxiety with positivity. Now, all that goes back to what we started with. In other words, it goes back to the whole formula of taking control of the conscious mind. So just to put it back, to summarize so we understand how this all works. The way to have an effective life is we have to have mastery. We have to be in control of what we're thinking about and therefore what we're feeling and how we're behaving. The only way to do that is to stop the flow of impulsive and irrational negative influences which often come from the subconscious. Sometimes it comes from the subconscious in a well-meaning way, as we explain. The subconscious creates reality sometimes to protect us, like puts us into denial, puts us into a state of anxiety, supposedly to protect us so that we should be afraid and worry about the things that could harm us, but it overdoes it, so therefore it creates an unnecessary level of stress which is destructive and unhealthy, and so on and so forth, all the things we talked about that the irrational and subconscious mind does to us. The only way we can stop that is because the irrational mind connects with the emotion. The only way to stop that is to take control of the conscious mind. How do we take control of the conscious mind? So putting last week and this week together, we've got to do two things. If I can just go back to that. Give me one second. So it'll be clear. Here we are. Oh, okay. There's the fifth one, right? The fifth one is action. So always like this. The conscious mind, we need to do two things. We need to connect it with number one, with the essence of who we are, because that overrides the subconscious. The essence of who we are is not about impulsivity. It's about truth. It's about clarity. It's about the healthy identity of ourselves. It's about assertiveness, as we talked about last week. That's connecting our conscious mind with the first level. But it also means to connect the conscious mind with number five, which is our garments, our thought, speech, and action. Those are the things we have real control of. And to reclaim our conscious mind is to work with the means of expression, to work with the garments of the soul, to work with thought, speech, and action, because that we can control. We can control what we think about, we control what we speak about, and we control what we do including things like apparently faking things that are positive until we become it, because it makes our heart follow in that direction. When we connect the conscious mind with our essence of who we really are, we create for ourselves a positive identity, an identity of assertiveness, an identity of strength, an identity of clarity. And we also engage with our thought, speech, and action to make sure that we choose the right thoughts, the right speech, and the right actions. That's how we get our conscious mind working in the way we want it to work. And once our conscious mind works in the way we want it to work, the conscious mind then will breed the emotions which come from the mind in a much more healthy, strong, and stable way. So that's the strategy of how we work and take control of the conscious minds. In terms of effectiveness and motivation, of course, there's a lot more to talk about, which we'll do over the next few weeks. Have a good day.